Well, thank you very much for the nice introduction and the opportunity to give this talk. So I would like to give a kind of more pedagogical overview of numerical relativity in half an hour. This is a very ambitious thing, and I already apologize in advance to everybody whose work I do not give full credit to. It's certainly not intentional. I try and do my best. So the one thing I would like to probably ask is to what extent are people familiar with general relativity. So I assume everybody knows what a metric is. Everybody knows that the metric describes space-time curvature, and that's Einstein's notion of how gravity works, as opposed to having a force. It's just a curvature of the manifold on which objects are moving, which changes the distance. Just like what's happening to two travelers who start on the North Pole and move due south, why they will separate if they move on at different longitudes, and then they will converge again at the South Pole. But first of all, let me give a brief overview. The talk has roughly has three parts. I will first give an introduction and a bit of a motivation. I will then say very little about the history, simply for time reasons. And then probably the largest part of the talk. In the largest part of the talk, I would like to summarize the most important results that numerical relativity has produced so far, and that will also be with some relevance in some connection with the data analysis part that Duncan is going to talk about in the second half. So first of all, I would like to say a bit about the motivation. Of numerical relativity, this is, in a sense, not quite trivial. I mean, for us it might not appear trivial, but if you actually look at the concept of black holes, for a long time black holes were viewed rather as a mathematical curiosity, rather than physical reality, not to mention physical reality with strong astrophysical significance. But that picture has changed dramatically, and black holes and of course also neutron stars now play an important role in many areas in astrophysics, and also they're starting to play an important role in fundamental physics. I would just like to mention the LHC, where people are actually hoping to generate black holes in collider experiments. In astrophysics, black holes are now almost uniformly believed to exist, because the evidence, even though indirect, is quite convincing. So black holes exist is maybe a slightly too strong statement, but I think the evidence is so convincing that hardly anybody doubts their existence. And there are essentially two categories of black holes that astrophysicists distinguish. One is the end product of a stellar evolution, where you have a massive star which has a mass of 20 or solar masses or larger, and as it runs out of fuel, collapses, there's simply no way to stop the gravitational collapse, and it will end up as a black hole. So they're part of the stellar graveyard, so to say. The other type of black hole is the supermassive type of black hole that it is believed to exist at the cores, at the centers of certainly the more massive galaxies, quite possibly at the center of most galaxies. And observational evidence for this kind of black hole comes from observations of stars moving near the center of our own Milky Way. So these stars have been observed for several decades now, I think. And if you look at the trajectories, you simply can infer how much mass you need inside the trajectory to actually cause such a motion. And there's simply no model other than black holes which explains this kind of mass. So this is the sort of the observational evidence in favor of the existence of black holes. And the significance of black holes goes all the way from structures of the galaxies. If you look at the cores of galaxies, there are lots of signatures which the presence of a black hole would leave behind, such as the density profile, the velocity dispersion, and so there's also the role that black holes play in the structure formation of the universe. and all these things, we hope we will be able to observe actually with gravitational waves. So with that, I would like to give you a brief outline of what numerical relativity is actually about. So that I think I need my sheet of notes. So the target of numerical relativity is conceptually very simple. You want the metric. If you have the metric of a space-time, you have virtually everything that you need. You can calculate the connection, the Riemann tensor, any property of the space-time you would like. Also, ADM masses, gravitational radiation. All you need is the metric of the whole space-time, or, as we will see later on in practice, in a good chunk of it. But of course, this is sort of a difficult thing to do because of the Einstein equations. So the Einstein equations are usually written this way. And of course this looks simple, but this is one of these things which general relativity often does. It fools the eye by giving you a compact notation for something which in reality is horrendously complicated. So this little thing we called capital G on the left-hand side is actually a complex function of the metric and its first and second derivatives. And the thing on the right-hand side the metatensor, and that can take on all kinds of shapes because there's of course a huge variety of different metatypes. You can assume that it describes a scalar field, you can assume that it describes a perfect fluid, which often is done for neutron star simulations. You can assume that it is a kind of cosmological spread out homogeneous meta distribution. You can start doing very complicated things by having highly realistic but very difficult descriptions of matter, including shear and all kinds of things. Actually, for black holes, this is zero. And I have to admit that I'm largely a person who likes simplicity, so I'm largely working on black holes. I will also say some things about neutron stars, and these are largely things I picked up in Matt Huey's nice talk on Friday. But I apologize if I don't do full justice to the neutron star community. It's really just because I'm not quite as much involved in that work as I am with black holes. As you can quite easily show, the G alpha in that case is identical to the Ricci tensor, and the Einstein equations that one has to solve in the black hole case is simply the fact that the Ricci tensor vanishes. That's all. Of course, finding solutions to the Einstein equations is trivial. Right? You take any metric, you have complete freedom. You take the metric, you plug it into this tensor. There's a textbook recipe for how to calculate this, and then you take into account the factor of 8 pi, you've got t, that's your solution. So any metric is a solution. The only question is, of course, how realistic is the meta source? And of course, the normal case is, it is a nice curiosity, but realized absolutely nowhere in the universe as far as we know it. So the difficulty is is finding realistic solutions, which describe something out there in physics, which we try to observe. That can be a black hole binary, a neutron star collapsing supernova or whatever. And this is really, really hard. Because there, we have to do the reverse process. We specify a metatensor. Could be vacuum, could be a matter source describing a collapsing neutron supernova, and then we have to solve this equation, which is a set of 10 independent partial differential equations of second order for the metric. We have to solve this, and this really is then the solution for our space-time. That is difficult. That's the tricky part. As a matter of fact, Einstein never really believed people would find realistic solutions at all, at least not analytic. And he was quite surprised when Karl Schwarzschild managed actually to find one of the most important solutions within, say, half a year of the publication of GR. That, of course, is the Schwarzschild solution, the single spherically symmetric black hole. And it's so nice and easy. But I can even write it down. I have to be careful now. Because if I get this wrong... I won't mention any names, but I once was at a talk where the speaker said, the Schwarzschild solution, if you don't know that, you're at the wrong conference. He misspelled the name Schwarzschild, and he got the metric wrong.
You've already forgotten your dt squared, your dr squared.
Thank you. Okay, So my philosophy in lectures when I teach at university is whenever I get something wrong and I have to add something, I use a different color. So I use this nice pink one here. Okay, that's the Schwarzschild metric. It's so nice and easy. You can write it on the back of an envelope. You can almost write it on a stamp. And of course, that metric has helped people enormously to understand GR much better. But the key thing here is you can only find the solution because it assumes highly idealized scenarios. And the key word here is symmetry. So this solution is time independent. Therefore, you have symmetry in time. You have symmetry in both angular directions, so it's a 1D problem. This is why it was comparatively easy to find that solution. The moment you relax symmetry, life becomes much, much more difficult. And it took the community several decades until the solution in the two-dimensional axisymmetric problem was found, which, of course, is the Kerr solution. That already shows you how difficult things become. That was going from 1D to 2D. What we are trying to do is generate solutions which actually have no symmetry. So you go from two to four dimensions. And there it is, with all fairness to the analytic community, it's impossible to generate solutions. And this is where numerical relativity comes in. Put a question mark in brackets because who knows, maybe someday a genius will come up and actually find something. But at the moment it appears really impossible to us. So what's the way out of this problem? Because many problems in reality in astrophysics will not be spherically or axially symmetric. So what can we do? There are basically two paths open to you. One is you approximate the theory. And this is a very successful approach, of course, and post-Newtonian theory is one such idea. To approximate the theory, you just take GR and expand it around Newtonian theory. Well, just in quotation marks, horribly difficult. It's a very complex and difficult field. But it allows you to expand your solution in a parameter V over C, or M over R, where mass over radius. And it allows you, with remarkable precision, to approximate many scenarios. So that's post-Newtonian theory. Another alternative is perturbation theory. In perturbation theory, you linearize the Einstein equations. I should have said that this function is linear in the metric and the first derivatives, not in the second. Still, it's a nonlinear theory. In perturbation theory, you linearize around a known background. This works very well when you know that your solution is very similar to a solution you already know. This can happen, for example, in an extreme mass ratio binary, where you have one supermassive black hole and a tiny object, say a neutron star or a black hole, orbiting around the massive black hole. In that case, you know that your solution has to be very similar to the single black hole solution without the neutron star. And then you expand, you take the differences, in the metric between the real solution and the analytic solution. You plug the whole thing into Einstein's equations, you linearize, that's perturbation theory, and perturbation theory also has provided us with invaluable insight. And it, for example, it describes extremely well the latest part of a black hole coalescence and merger, the so-called ring down. So that's one approach. The other approach is that you do not simplify the equations, but in a sense the way you solve them. And that's numerical relativity. So you take the full Einstein equations, but you say, okay, I'm not going to assume that I will find exact solutions to these equations. I will approximate, in a sense, again, by using finite differencing or other numerical methods, for spectrum methods, for example. And this is the field I would like to say a little more in the rest of this talk. So what we need first is a recipe. For numerical relativity, because we face lots of challenges here. These equations are, in their nature, differential equations of differential geometry. We have to convert that somehow into something which only involves numbers. And numerical work quite often has the idea of evolving systems in time. That is a classic approach in describing physical systems which undergo it, which evolve in time, that you do the same thing numerically. You start with a snapshot of the system at a particular moment in time. There can be, for example, two cars at some positions on the highway. And then you know the velocities of the cars. Suppose you know something about the equations that governs the evolution. In this case, it will be the gravitational attraction of the car. Maybe you involve also some friction with the highway, whatever. And then you can calculate the exact trajectories of the cars. Of course, usually there sit some people in the car who push the pedal, and that's more difficult to model. But the key idea is the same thing. And it turns out that you can do the same thing in general relativity. It is non-trivial that you can do this, because if you look at the equations, the differential geometry part of the theory, it actually does not really single out a direction, a time direction or anything. So it is actually a non-trivial calculation that you can do this, that you can formulate the Einstein equations as a so-called initial value problem. All this IVP. And as it turns out, there's a lot of freedom how you can do this. So one thing I will not say a lot about is the so-called characteristic formulations, where you use the light cones, the characteristics of the Einstein equations, to create a foliation of your space-time. This approach has turned out to be very, very successful in many areas. It just has one problem which I think the community has not yet managed to overcome. If you have caustics, that is, the light rays intersect, they start at a common point, they diverge, but then they converge again. And that's a caustic, like in gravitational lensing. And this means that your code will crash. And I think the community still is basically stopped to use the characteristic formulation for binaries by this problem. But it turns out that you can also use a so-called 3+1 split. And this is sort of contrary to all the GR lectures that you've probably taken. So the first thing they taught me in my GR lecture was space and time cease to exist, the famous Minkowski statement, cease to exist as independent concepts. Henceforth, they shall only exist as a common space-time. Well, the first thing you learn in your numerical relativity lectures, well, let's reverse this. So you have your four-dimensional space-time. I would suppress one dimension because I cannot draw four-dimensional things. And you chop it up like a sausage into lots of slices. I will only draw two of them. And you label these with a time coordinate. Of course, you have lots of those, and the whole pile then makes up a four-dimensional chunk. And what you also do is to decompose or to rewrite your 10 metric components into 10 other functions. I write them down here, but you really don't have to memorize them. All I'm saying is that you rearrange your degrees of freedom. So instead of having 10 four-dimensional metric components, it's symmetric. This is why you have 10 components, of course. You decompose it into 6 three-metric components, which describes the geometry of each hypersurface, and then you have these 4 functions. It turns out that they incorporate the coordinate or gauge freedom of general relativity. And then they play an important role in the next part I would like to discuss. And what you do then is you get equations for these variables. And they are evolution equations. So you have, in a simple way, you have second order and time evolution equations for the three metric variables. Those are the Einstein equations. Unfortunately, there's also another set of equations which you turn out to get from this decomposition, and they don't involve any time derivatives at all. That means they don't tell you anything about your evolution. They are constraints. So you have what happens is you have 10 equations and they split into 6 evolution constrained equations. Now there's a much deeper theory behind all this, and I wouldn't profess to really understand all of this, but these 4 constraints are intricately related to the fact that you have these gauge variables, alpha and beta I. The Latin index goes from 1 to 3, so there are 3 variables here, 1 here, so there's 4 variables. And the fact that you have 4 gauge variables implies in some sense that you also have 4 constraints. This is one of the key things that makes numerical relativity very difficult. But it is not unique to general relativity. You have a similar thing in electromagnetic theory, where the fact that the electric field is divergence-free is also a constraint. So what you have to do is you must solve the evolution equations to get your evolutions, and you also need to make sure that you have your constraints solved, but the constraints need to be solved in each of these slices. We are lucky because it can be shown that it is enough to make sure that the constraints are solved on your initial slice. Leaving aside numerical problems, you are then guaranteed that the constraints will always be guaranteed to be satisfied. So they are, in a sense, preserved under the evolution of the system. Okay. So this is the initial value problem. But formulating the equations actually does not end here, because you still have the question, which variables do you choose? Do you use these variables? And it turns out that's not a good idea. It took the community decades to find out, but it does not seem to work. But you can combine or you can rearrange these free functions in an infinite number of possible ways. This whole problem is usually called the formulation of the Einstein equations. And I haven't got the time to go into any details here. But I would like to mention that two successful systems have been found. And found in this context mean that there have been successful evolutions of black hole and neutron star mergers using two different rearrangements of the degrees of freedom. Actually, the generalized harmonic formulation pretty much does not take the way around the 3 plus 1 decomposition, but pretty much straightforwardly starts with the 4 metric. But this is a detail which is not consequential for the purpose of this talk. The BSSN equation is a rearrangement of these degrees of freedoms. It also introduces an extra variable, which is, does not matter. The key point here is that we have two families of formulations of the Einstein equation. They're both initial value formulations, and they both have the idea of a 3 plus 1 decomposition. That means they evolve successive slices of three-dimensional hypersurfaces. That's the Baumgartel-Shapiro-Shibata-Nakamura system. The first version actually was published by Shibata and Nakamura, I think, in 95. And then Baumgartel and Shapiro found a modification that turned out to be even more successful in numerical relativity. So these four people are generally considered the inventors of the system. Okay. We still have to discuss the gauge. So these are called the lapse function alpha and the shift vector beta I. And I will keep this very short for two reasons. First of all, I haven't got the time. The second reason is that the community still only has a partial understanding of why some of these choices work or don't work. So the first thing to notice is that these variables, alpha and beta, do not appear in the Einstein equations, or the Einstein equations don't determine their evolution. Which makes sense, because this is the coordinate freedom, and it's up to you as a numerical relativist to choose your coordinates. You can do whatever you like with them. You can choose any prescription for alpha and beta. The physics of the spacetime is not affected by this. The one thing that will be affected is the success of your code. And for that purpose, I would like to go back to the Schwarzschild metric. You see that you have this nasty thing here, this 2m over r, the famous coordinate singularity. At r equals 0, of course, you have the physical singularity. That's one problem. The other problem is that at r equal to m, you have a coordinate singularity. Nothing goes wrong with your physics. But suppose your numerical code generates something like that. The computer cannot handle infinities. The computer divides by zero, you're immediately screwed. So you must make sure with your gauge choices, alpha and beta, that this does not happen. And this has turned out to be, in my opinion, the biggest problem in numerical relativity. Maybe together with the formulations. These two ingredients, in my opinion, are the answer why things now work and why things did not work for such a long time. I should not say more because I'm really running out of time. I would only like to mention that there are lots of technical issues that you have to take care of in black hole simulations, also neutron star simulations, like mesh refinement. Of course, these simulations are huge. You need to parallelize and all that. It's difficult, but basically most of these problems have been overcome, at least in the sense that we can generate solutions. There's still accuracy issues, but that's a different matter. Okay, as far as the history is concerned, I will only spend 30 seconds on that, and I would only like to say that the first simulation started in the 60s and 70s, largely on axisymmetric space-times, and all the simulations all the way until 2005 were plagued by instabilities. For some of the reasons that I mentioned, the formulation turned out to be weakly hyperbolic, which means something which is not good for the numerics. The gauges were leading to coordinate singularities. Some of the technical infrastructure was not there, like mesh refinement. There were problems with the real singularity at r equals zero, a problem we can solve by cutting it out and so on. So in a nutshell, there were lots of problems people encountered, and it was not until 2005, in several decades of many attempts by people, that Franz Pretorius, in this case, actually simulated the first complete merger and spiral. He used this GHG system, this generalized harmonic gauge formulation, and fairly shortly afterwards, there was an alternative method, the so-called moving puncture approach, which was simultaneously discovered by the Brownsville and Goddard group. And this method uses the BSSN formulation. So there are these two families of codes around, GHG codes and BSSN codes. And there are about 10 groups now, or 10 codes, which are capable of simulating black hole binaries. In neutron stars, the same is true. I think the majority of codes for neutron star and spirals and mergers use BSSN, but I think the LSU group, Luis, correct me if I'm wrong, uses the generalized harmonic scheme. So again, also for neutron stars, you have both formulations. Actually, neutron star and spirals were successful a little earlier than the black holes. They actually were able to simulate a couple of orbits already, I think, in the 1990s. Okay, and in the remaining, how much time have I left? Maybe 5-10 minutes? Okay, right. Okay, so now I would like to present the results. It's a pity I should. And I will focus on black hole in spirals. And I will start with the simplest possible configuration, and that's the configuration that has been most extensively studied. So you start with two black holes. They have no spin. They are equal in mass. And you just start them one here and one here. And what they do is, I try to... Oh, gee, I'm not shy if this is going to work. Anyway. Oh, careful. So that's what they do. They're in spiral because they lose energy from gravitational radiation, and at some stage they merge. Right? So what we would like to calculate from this are physics, and the most important physics are the gravitational waves. So it's a gravitational wave signal that we want. I'm not going to say how we do that. Just there's discussion, there's some work going on how to improve the methods we're using. But let's assume for the moment that these are satisfactorily accurate. So the gravitational waves is the kind of ripple in space-time that a detector at some very, very large distance, much larger, I would have to dig in the basement to show you where the detector really is, sees from this in spiral. And this function is, you can call it the strain, it's a function of time if you fix the direction from the binary to the observer. But since the observer can have any location relative to the binary, or as a data analyst would say, the binary can have any location relative to the detector, there are two further angles which come into play here. This is the angular position is of the detector as viewed from the binary, or if you prefer the other way around, it doesn't matter. So in reality, the gravitational waveform of a binary is a function of three variables. It turns out that you can simplify this. In spherical harmonics, spin-weighted spherical harmonics. And this decomposition into some known, analytically known angular functions of the angular coordinates and some amplitudes which have these multiple indices, that's actually the reason why you almost always see one-dimensional plots for a waveform. So for something like this, the waveform will look, it's going to look terrible, but I'm going to try my best. Approximately, this is how it looks like. And in a black hole binary and spiral, you have sort of three parts. You have the inspirer, you have the merger, and you have the ring down.
That's fixed L and M.
Excuse me?
That's fixed L and M.
I'm sorry, yes. And it is usually for L equal 2 and M equal 2. Thanks for pointing this out. Because it turns out that most of the energy is radiated in the two L equal 2, M equal plus or minus 2 mode. So it is actually possible to summarize 98% of all the gravitational radiation in this one-dimensional function. So this is a key result for the equimass non-spinning and spiral. People were maybe a little bit disappointed because they expected something more exciting, something more Mickey Mouse shaped to go on here. But it doesn't seem to happen. And there's almost a kind of universality of the merger part of the waveform. However, still life is fortunately in some sense is not quite as trivial as that, because as you change the black hole parameters, of course, lots of things happen. And for unequal masses, you can show that the higher order multiples become more important. That's one thing which is probably of very high importance for gravitational wave detection and parameter estimation. Another thing happens, and this is really a fundamentally new thing. You do not only radiate away energy, you also radiate away linear momentum. And by virtue of conservation of linear momentum, this means that the merged black hole has a kick. And one key question that the relativity community has been facing for a long time, and there's been lots of work going into this, is how big is the kick? So after this merger, if the black holes have unequal masses, the whole thing eventually will move away with some finite velocity, the merged black hole. And it turns out that for unequal masses, I think it was 178 kilometers per second for a mass ratio of 3. So that is one nice illustration how numerical relativity has been able to provide an important answer of significant astrophysical interest. Then if you add spins, it turns out that this kick actually becomes much stronger. So the first simulations with kicks immediately gave, with black holes with spins, immediately gave kicks of the size of 500 kilometers per second. And even configurations with kicks of 2,500 kilometers per second have been found.
Are there numbers for solar mass black holes?
They are independent of the mass.
What?
So that's some...
Independent of the mass?
Yes. It's B is dimensionless, so you don't need any scale at all. And this is larger than the escape velocities from large elliptic galaxies, and astrophysicists and many groups are now working out the consequences of what would happen if these kicks were really more generic. They possibly are not, but still, this magnitude came as a big surprise. Okay, I'm almost running out of space and blackboard, but I would like to conclude with a few other key results that people have found. So one important question, in particular with the data analysis effort, is how well do the approximations that I've mentioned earlier, in particular post-Newtonian and numerical waveforms, agree? And probably Duncan is going to say a little more about that. But people have studied this very intensively in this case, in the equal mass non-spinning binaries, and people have found that up to, say, 3-4 orbits before the merger, actually there seems to be a fairly good agreement between post-Newtonian and numerical relativity. The details of all these studies I cannot work out here, but depending on your viewpoint, some people may have expected better agreement, some people may have expected worse agreement, but still it is, if you plot the waveforms from PN and numerical relativity, they look, at least by eye, they look remarkably similar up until, say, some orbits before the merger, which at least is somehow encouraging, because we can now build combined waveforms out of post-Newtonian theory and numerical relativity and use that in data analysis. Other types of black hole simulations people did is with spins, is that the spin can significantly delay or accelerate the inspiral. This is sometimes known as an orbital hang-up effect. Although I'm not entirely sure whether this word has not been used in other contexts before. And another thing we are starting to investigate now are high-energy collisions of black holes, where you just take two black holes, and this is nothing which is happening in galaxies or so far away, but this is somewhat more similar to what you would do in a collider. You take two black holes and hit them head-on with each other, but with very, very large fields, and we're awaiting the results to come out of that. Of course, people will also start investigating much more systematically the spin parameter space. Some work has been gone into trying to model the final spin of generic black hole simulations. There's been work on numerical relativity and also analytic work trying to predict a recipe for the final spin, the spin population of black holes resulting from mergers, which will also be very important because it affects the accretion efficiency and so on. It's important for black hole formation. So I'm not going to be complete anyway, so I'm sorry and I apologize to Duncan, but I would like to hand over to him now.
Okay, great, thank you. Can you make these? Okay, so I... Now we're going to talk somewhat about the sources and the work that numerical relativists have been doing to model the sources of gravitational waves. I'm going to switch gears and talk a little bit about the detection problem. So, I'm going to focus basically on the LIGO detection problem. So I'm not going to touch the ground-based gravitational wave observatory. I'm not going to mention LISA, which is the space-based gravitational observatory, given the time constraints. So let me just say roughly. So Uli mentioned that the thing that they're modeling is the gravitational wave strain. This function h of t that's generated by the sources, and this is exactly what we're trying to detect, buried in detector noise in gravitational wave detectors. So, the detection problem for LIGO is basically to look at the data that's coming out of the detectors and decide whether or not there's a gravitational wave signal in there. Then there's another parameter estimation problem, which is to say, okay, once we observe the signal, what are the parameters of the signal? How can we extract the masses, the spins, the sky location? And for both of these problems, so both the detection and parameter estimation, it's going to be very important for the LIGO data analysts and also LISA data analysts to talk to the numerical relativity community, and I'm going to try and give you a rough outline today of why that's so important. So the effect of this gravitational wave strain that's generated by binary black holes or binary neutron star systems on the Earth is to cause a change in length, so a change in the measured length. So the canonical picture is if I have a gravitational wave signal that's passing through the board, so in the z-axis, and I have a ring of particles like this at some time t equals zero, then the effect of the gravitational wave generated by these binary black holes as it passes through the board is to stretch the ring of particles in one direction after a quarter of a period, and then return to a circle, stretch in the other direction, squeeze in the other direction. This is 3. And then return to a circle after a period. Okay, so this is the effect of a gravitational wave as it passes through the board. And how do we actually detect this this gravitational wave strain? Well, we build gravitational wave detectors like LIGO, where we take a laser and we shine laser light into a beam splitter, reflect it off a mirror up here, half the light goes up this mirror up here, half the light goes to another mirror down here, the light gets reflected back towards the beam splitter, recombined, and if these arms are exactly the same length, then there'll be no light coming out of the photodetector, and we can read off a voltage signal here, and then if we know the calibration of our instrument, we can convert that back into the gravitational wave signal that's received at the detector. The LIGO detectors are a little bit more complicated than this. In order to actually measure gravitational wave strains that we might expect to receive on Earth, the amplitude of a gravitational wave basically goes as the gravitational wave amplitude goes as roughly g over c to the fourth times the second time derivative of the quadrupole moment of the source, and g over c to the fourth is a pretty small number. There's a factor of 1 over r in here for the distance scaling. And so if we're detecting these things at astrophysical distances, if we plug numbers in here, for example, if we plug the numbers for the mass and the masses of the Hulse-Taylor pulsar in here, which we know is a source of gravitational waves, we end up with a gravitational wave strain of something like 10 to the minus 19. So these are the strains that we're actually trying to measure with LIGO, and this is the upper end of the strains. So this is for the Hulse-Taylor pulsar, which we know is a source of gravitational waves in the universe. We've observed it over many years, and we've seen that the change in period is if you plot the period of the Hulse-Taylor pulsar as a function of time. So this is time in years of observations. This is the period. You see the observations from radio measurements give us the period. And then if we plot the prediction from general relativity, we see a nice theoretical curve from general relativity if this change in period is due to the emission of gravitational waves, and it lies very nicely along these lines. So this is a known source of gravitational waves in the universe, and its strain is around 10 to the minus 19. Unfortunately, Hulse-Taylor won't coalesce. The frequency of Hulse-Taylor at the moment is something like 10 to the minus 2 hertz, which is very far below the sensitivity of these LIGO detectors. In order for it to enter the sensitivity band of LIGO detectors, we're going to have to wait for another 300 million years before the Hulse-Taylor pulsar enters the sensitivity band of LIGO detectors. So to overcome that, and the fact we've only seen about a dozen of these binary neutron systems in the galaxy, we need to be more sensitive to gravitational wave strains. We actually need to be sensitive to strains of order something like 10 to the minus 22 to have a hope of seeing gravitational waves. And advanced LIGO will be even more sensitive, and I'll talk about that at the end of the talk. So what's the problem with detecting gravitational waves? If we can build a detector that has strength sensitivities around 10 to the minus 22, which we can, we've built the initial LIGO detectors, and they're now currently operating at this sensitivity. The problem is we also have noise sources in the detector, and that's what limits our sensitivity. And the fundamental noise sources for the detector are, so if I sketch what we draw often in LIGO, which is the LIGO noise curve. And if you take the Fourier transform, this is basically just the power spectrum of the detector data that comes out of here. So if you Fourier transform the data, and this tells you how much noise power there is in the detector data at different frequencies. And it looks something like this, where there are three pieces to the fundamental noise source. Let me just put some numbers on here. So this, for the LIGO detectors, this most sensitive band here is around 100 to 200 hertz. This so-called seismic wall here is around 40 hertz, and then up here we go up to 10 kilohertz where things don't get very interesting again. So what limits the sensitivity of these detectors to gravitational waves are three fundamental noise sources. The first is this piece here, which is caused by seismic noise. So in order to measure the gravitational wave strain, we have to make very precise measurements of the length of these arms so we can see any change in length of these arms that's caused by a gravitational wave passing through the board. And it'll pass through the detector, rather. And there are many other things that can cause the length of the arms to change, and these are what gives us these noise sources. The first noise source that I've just mentioned is the seismic noise, which is just ground motion coupling through the isolation into the suspensions of these mirrors, causes the mirrors to shake, and that noise motion caused by the seismic shaking gives us this fundamental limit to the sensitivity here. What this noise curve really tells us is that below this curve, the noise source and our instrument just dominate any observations we can make. Above this noise curve is where we have a hope of seeing signals that we can actually detect. The second piece is from thermal noise sources. So these are from fluctuations in the suspension wires, thermal fluctuations in the suspension wires that are suspending the mirrors, and also thermal fluctuations of the mirrors themselves. So Brownian motion fluctuations of the mirror surface when you're measuring distances of 10 to the minus 18 meters. So if this is a 4 kilometer LIGO arm, then you're sensitive to these Brownian noise fluctuations in the surface of the mirrors. And that gives us our other noise source just here. And then the final noise source, or final fundamental noise source, is something called photon shot noise, which is a quantum effect that comes from the accuracy at which we can measure wavefronts arriving back at the beam splitter. By measuring wavefronts, we're effectively measuring delta a time arrival, and we have the uncertainty relation delta E, delta T is bigger than h bar over 2, and so we need to get a decent amount of light arriving here so we can measure the phase of the gravitational wave, the phase of the light arriving, which encodes the gravitational wave signal. And turning up the laser power can reduce this shot noise because we have more energy. Unfortunately, there's not a lot we can do about seismic and thermal unless we actually re-engineer our suspensions and our mirrors. So this is the prototypical LIGO design noise curve, and this bucket here, the so-called most sensitive region, is about 3 times 10 to the minus 23. And in previous, a couple of years ago, it would have been very difficult to give this as a blackboard talk because I would be showing progressions of noise curves as the sensitivity of the LIGO detectors increase.
Are you going to say that's for
root curves? Yes, sorry. I'll be showing progressions of the LIGO instruments as they were commissioned down towards this design sensitivity. But the nice thing I can say now is the initial LIGO detectors, which were taking data for the last 2 years, reached this design sensitivity, and the noise curve for the real detectors followed this, apart from very slight deviation up at the lowest frequencies, followed this design noise curve very well. So initial LIGO, in terms of reaching its design sensitivity goals, has been a great success. It's achieved design sensitivity. We've taken data for the past 2 years from the three LIGO detector sites. We have, from the three LIGO detectors at the two sites, we have the LIGO Hanford Observatory, where there are two detectors. And we have the LIGO Livingston Observatory, where there is one detector. And these detectors have been recording data. We have two years of data, or a year of coincident data in the can, because the detectors don't operate all the time. And We have plans to upgrade these detectors. Commissioning is ongoing to upgrade these detectors' sensitivity by a factor of 2 in this region here. And then the advanced LIGO detectors that I mentioned at the end are going to upgrade the sensitivity both here and here. So why is it important that we talk to numerical relativists? Well, in order to find signals in this detector data, we use a technique called match filtering, where we take the noisy data stream that comes out the LIGO detectors, and we correlate it with a template, which is basically the signal that we're looking for. So, as I said in the beginning, the detection problem is to determine if we have the signal or detector data, is it just noise, which isn't very interesting, or is it noise plus some actual gravitational wave signal from astrophysical sources. And to do this, we construct this a detection statistic, which we call the signal-to-noise ratio. And it's basically, up to factors of 4, it's the correlation, and we do this correlation in the frequency domain, between the... it's a correlation between the detector data, the template signal we're looking for, weighted by the average noise power spectrum of the detector. And this Fourier transform here is just so we can search over many time arrivals of gravitational waves in one operation. So what you can think of this doing is you take your S of T, your noisy detector data, you correlate it with some waveform that you obtain from numerical relativity or post-Newtonian theory or perturbation theory. You weight by this LIGO detector noise curve, and you get some detection statistic, signal-to-noise ratio, that tells you how likely it is that there's actually a signal in the data at any given time. And if the detector data is just noise, well, you put noise in here, and you get noise out. But if at some time there's actually a signal buried in this noise, then when the if you imagine this just being noise, then these are drawn from some Gaussian distribution, and so it's as likely that subsequent samples will be as positive as negative. And so when you multiply these two together pointwise, then this point and this point could be positive, this point and this point could be negative, this point and this point could be negative, and when you add all these points up, you get some number that's just drawn from a random distribution. Whereas if you actually have a signal in here, then you have noise plus a little bit of this, and all those little pieces, when you multiply them together, are going to have the same sign. So when you add them all up, you'll get a spike in your detection statistic that tells you that you actually have a signal in the data. And so at the grossest level, the LIGO detection problem is to look at is to take some template, correlate it with our data, and determine if there's some peak in the detection statistic. How much time do I have left, by the way? I guess
5 minutes.
Okay. So the reason it's very important to talk to the numerical relativists is the most sensitive search, this optimal search, needs information about the source. Now, we can get some of this information from post-Newtonian theory and also from perturbation theory, as Uli said. There are three approaches to this. We can look at approximations, the post-Newtonian theory, which can give us template signals to look for in the regime where post-Newtonian is valid, so typically sources where the velocity of the objects is much less than the speed of light. We can also use perturbation theory to give us templates in the case of where we're perturbing about some final object, and this can give us the ring down signal, where we have, say, a Kerr black hole, we add some perturbations and give us a ring down signal. So in the regime, so if I extend this down here, early in the InSpiral we can use post-Newtonian theory, At the very late times for black hole mergers, we can use perturbation theory to give us the ring down signal, and we can construct analytic templates and match filter. But there's this regime in the middle where we need numeric relativity to tell us what's going on. And how important is this? Well, let me just sketch a plot that tells you how important the information that we get is. So if we look at the distance to which we can see sources with the initial LIGO detectors, and remember that the number of sources we can see scales as the volume, so it scales as the distance cubed. So if I look at the distance in megaparsecs to which the LIGO detectors are sensitive to sources, and then we look at the mass of the systems in solar masses, what we see is that if we start down here at total solar mass of, so this is total mass of the system, so just think about equal mass systems for a minute. If we start down here at 2, then we start, this is roughly binary neutron stars, then the initial LIGO detectors can see roughly 20 megaparsecs. And the amplitude of the signals scales roughly as the amplitude scales as the reduced mass times the total mass to the 2/3. So we get some, on a log-log plot, we get some scaling that looks like this. Okay, so as we increase the mass, we increase the distance we can see. But at some point, what happens is the ending frequency of these signals scales as the inverse of the total mass of the system. So if I sketch this on the noise curve for the low-mass systems, it might be down here, and it may sweep all the way up to this frequency, so we can see a good chunk of the in-spiral. But for higher mass systems, although the mass might be much higher, the system actually coalesces, so this is where we have the merger and ring down. For higher mass systems, the merger and ring down might be right in the band. So although we gain in amplitude, we lose because the coalescence frequency is in our band. And what happens is this starts to turn over and come down like this, as you see less and less of the in spiral as this moves up and across like this. Okay. And for post-Newtonian signals, where we end the signal at r equals 6m, so when the binary separation is about r equals 6m, the maximum distance we can see is about 100 megaparsecs, and this is about 25 solar masses total. So that's 25 total solar masses for the binary. Now, if we look at ring down signals, which is the other system we can do with perturbation theory, we can generate match filter templates. Well, the peak of the ring down range is about 200 solar masses, and we see a curve that looks something like this for the ring down signals, where this peak of the ring downs is about 450 megaparsecs for initial LIGO. Okay, so if we can look for the ring down templates using perturbation theory, this is the distance we're sensitive to as different masses. If we just look for the early in spiral part of the signal, this is the distance we're sensitive to, and you'll see there's a whole lot of stuff in here that we're not covering just by doing post-Newtonian templates stopping at r equals 6m and just doing waveforms from ring down from ring downs. And just to remind you again that the number of sources scales as the volume, which goes as d cubed. If we could have sensitivity in here, we would see an awful lot more of the universe. And that's basically what the name of the game is between getting information from numeric relativity into the detection searches. So one thing that Uli mentioned is that numeric relativity is telling us that post-Newtonian theory, at least in the equal mass non-spinning case, is valid much later than we might have thought. So instead of stopping the post-Newtonian theory here, we can actually push it quite a way into this merger and ring down. And so that allows us to extend this curve up here like this. So if we're doing an in-spiral search and we're stopping, let's say, at r equals 3m instead of r equals 6m, we push it for these systems that previously we didn't have any sensitivity to. We're getting distance sensitivities in the hundreds of megaparsecs for initial LIGO, and we're also improving the sensitivity here for these systems where it started to turn over.
But that, I mean, if you multiply this by any sort of initial mass function, right, then we know that, you know, it pulls everything down on the right.
It does. I mean, the actual. I'm purely talking about distance, if we can see.
But if you wrote down a rate with some reasonable IMF. The expectation would be all this stuff, why I haven't done it, but I'm trying to do it in my head real time. That, you know, I think they're all going to be down.
They would all be down, but they wouldn't. Great. But I doubt they will be down by that much.
Well, it's 1/m squared.
Yeah. But I mean, on the other hand, you know, for the black hole population synthesis, do we know what's out there for, you know, 30 solar mass black holes? I mean,
I'm talking about the stellar IMF. Something very simple, which is that for every 1/10 solar mass stars, we have some sense of how many 60 solar mass stars are formed. And just let all those go to black holes. That's the best you can do.
Right.
That's the most optimistic scenario. I think if you multiply that out, then you see that. You know, all that stuff that looks favorable in this sense becomes not so relevant.
That is true, but if we don't, I mean,
I'll say don't do it.
Yeah. so maybe, okay, I'm being a bit optimistic, and maybe I'm over.
Nuclei and globular clusters, where you could imagine coalescences and building up intermediates.
I'm just saying, take every single star and make all of them a black hole.
Right.
In a binary with a partner of equal mass. Do you think you can do better than that?
Cluster populations is one possible.
Yeah. Growing intermediate mass black holes in globular clusters. I mean,
understood, but again, but now you're down in mass by a factor of at least 100, because globular clusters are only 1%.
Right. So I'll acknowledge that, you know, it may not be as dramatic. It won't be as dramatic as if you just plot the distance you can see, but in the if you're looking for, let's say, for advanced LIGO, where you're sensitive to systems to much earlier, so in advanced LIGO you push things down, you're going to have systems where you're going to get coalescences at lower frequencies. It's what the actual population synthesis rates are, I don't know. But I mean, it won't be. It's not as dramatic as just the distance, because you have the population distance in there. But if you don't have the sensitivity here, you can't search for these sources at all. So you can't find something unexpected. So I guess the final thing I want to say on this is, then if you add in merger systems, you can push this all the way up here through to where you join up with the ring down, and so get the best distance sensitivity you can to being able to detect these sources out in the universe. And really, if you want to compete with the IMF, you need the distance. So if you're going to stand the hope of detecting anything, you need the best distance you can do, because the numbers of these sources are so far down. So I guess I'm really running out of time now. So let me just say the last thing. I mean, I've only talked about the detection problem. I haven't talked about parameter estimation. Once you detect the source, we're going to need information from numerical relativity to do parameter estimation, to extract the parameters of the binary, the masses, the spins, the orientation of the binary, and that's a whole other topic that I don't have time to go into, unfortunately. But let me just say what's next for LIGO. So the timeline for the LIGO detectors right now: we've completed the fifth science run, which is the first run of the LIGO detectors at this initial LIGO design sensitivity. Let me get the timeline correct. So the other thing we're doing now is commissioning something called Enhanced LIGO, which is taking the technologies, the advanced LIGO technologies that are ready now, and plugging them into the initial LIGO detectors. So, and by doing this, we think we can get, we won't change the seismic wall, but we think we can get a factor of roughly 2 in sensitivity over the initial LIGO detector, so a factor of 8 in volume. And that's just taking things like the more powerful advanced LIGO lasers that are ready now and some additional detector technologies for advanced LIGO and installing them into the initial LIGO detectors. And that should be completed hopefully around early 2009, and we will start S6, which will be a run of these enhanced LIGO detectors with a factor of 2 in sensitivity. And then we'll run the advanced LIGO detectors till roughly 2011, when we'll start installing and commissioning advanced LIGO. And this will do 2 things. This will push the seismic wall down from 40 hertz to 10 hertz, and push the sensitivity down by roughly a factor of 12 to 15 over the initial LIGO noise curves. 15 is probably optimistic. I'll erase that and just write 12. So and then in around 2015 we'll have advanced LIGO data taking. And then we'll be at the sensitivities where binary neutron star rates, the about 40 per year is the most likely rate for binary neutron stars in advanced LIGO. So we'll be in the situation where we are seeing sources. One brief last comment. We are doing astrophysics right now with LIGO. We're observing one of the nice results that's come out lately is a result on the gamma ray burst GRB070201, which was the localization of 070201 was thought to overlap with the Andromeda galaxy, which is not very far away, only 770 kiloparsecs, and LIGO has very good sensitivity to it. We're taking detector at the time. And by doing a binary neutron star analysis for this signal, we could exclude at extremely high confidence, greater than 99%, a binary neutron star progenitor for GRB070201 in the Andromeda galaxy. So although we haven't seen signals yet, we are actually doing astrophysics already, and I think it's probably fair to say we're on the cusp of really doing gravitational wave astronomy with LIGO. One of the things I completely glossed over in this is that our detector, we have many non-stationary noise transients in our data. And we improve our detection not just by match filtering, we also have additional filtering strategies that try and exclude noise-based transients. One of the most powerful things we have is coincidence between the LIGO detectors. So we demand that a gravitational wave signal is coincident between the 2 or 3 or 3 Virgo 4 gravitational wave detectors. How do we measure our background so we see how likely it is that some signal we observe at SNR10 is a gravitational wave? Well, we content off our detector source, like you can in particle physics. So what we do is we take data from the from 2 detectors, say Hamilton and Livingston, which the light travel time between the 2 detectors is 10 milliseconds, and we shift the detector data by more than 10 milliseconds. And so we can compute our rate of accidental coincidences that are just due to noise alone. And we do this many times in many time shifts. There are problems in doing this, but it's the best way we have at the moment to measure our background. And by doing that, we can make plots which show that we have signal to noise. So we can plot the number of triggers that have some signal to noise less than some threshold, and we can get some background rate from doing many of these time slide experiments, and then we can plot, or we get error bars on these, and we can plot the result of our so-called zero lag on top, and that's going to contain some noise triggers because of the way we tune our searches. So there'll be some noise triggers at low SNR, but maybe we'll get lucky, and at 1, we'll see something that stands out here. effect that's not present in the background estimation. And so we can compare this to our probability of seeing a noise figure of that SNR, and we can make statements about how likely it was that we saw, you know, if our background rate is 1 in 100 years, that signaled the noise, and we can quote that as how confident we are that signal is a gravitational wave, even though we have noise trends inside the detection.
Edward?
Yeah.
I apply also from the other program, and KATP and the WISDOM put these two together, probably not thinking that they have something together in common. But it turned out that our non-equilibrium phenomena, due to something which our string friends invented, has duality description between strongly coupled matter and some gravity problem. So our non-equilibrium problem, quickly speaking, going from something cold to something hot, can be formulated as going from some extreme black hole to non-extreme black hole with horizon when you dump some material in it. We are very naive people. We are on the level of Schwarzschild solution. And maybe you guys can help us.
Well, I hope there is a synergy. Can I ask a $300 million question?
Sure.
Do we know what happened in Mass LIGO and the Omnibus bill?
Not that way.
Yeah. Political answer?
It was okay. Email was sent out. I can tell you what I know, which is an email went out to LSE all saying the only book build is good news for advanced LIGO. If you want more information than that, ask that later.
Okay, Ron. Okay.
Yes.
Lovely speaking.